Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello, I'm Sophie Ellis-Bextor, and welcome to Spinning Plates, the podcast where I speak to busy working women who also happen to be mothers about how they make it work. I'm a singer, and I've released 7 albums in between having my 5 sons, aged 16 months to 16 years, so I spin a few plates myself. Being a mother can be the most amazing thing, but can also be hard to find time for yourself and your own ambitions. I want to be a bit nosy and see how other people balance everything. Welcome to Spinning Plates. Hey, hey, how have you been? Greetings from the land of the weekend. As I speak to you, it's Saturday afternoon, and it's been quite nice today. I've actually felt quite productive. Richard is away. He's been away all week, away with his band, doing some recording. And sometimes when you get to the weekend and you've got lots of kids, it can feel a bit daunting because you think, oh, what am I going to do with them all? But we've had a pretty good day, actually. Managed to get a couple of haircuts done. Not by me, took them somewhere. And my youngest had a little football thing this morning, and then there was a soft play moment, and I managed to get my favourite local coffee. And, yeah, a few other bits and bobs. So, you know, it's been a nice day of sort of pottering. And then tomorrow we're going to go to the cinema with my mum. So quite a nice little weekend, really. And then Richard's home tomorrow night, which will be lovely. And this week's been super quiet. I managed to... I've only been out one night, actually. I went to Dublin for a gig. Oh, and the last time I was speaking to you last weekend, I just got to the airport, hadn't I? And I was going away with my mum. That was really nice. I have to say, oh my gosh, that part of Scotland... So flipping beautiful, and we've got like the best weather ever. So we went on a very, very long sort of 3.5 hour walk, my mum and I, and it was absolutely stunning. So if you get a chance to go up that way, it was like 1.5 hours from Aberdeen, and a very, very lovely hotel called the Five Farms. But that whole part of Scotland is just gorgeous. So that was all really good. It's nice to spend time with my mater. And this week has been about... Well, I've recorded a couple of podcast episodes. I've also been doing getting things ready for the album, more of that, getting stuff ready. I've got a tour as well. I'm going on tour to Europe in a couple of weeks, which is the first time I've played some of those countries in absolutely ages. So I'm super excited about that. That's a real treat. Anyway, you didn't come here to hear about all that shenanigans. You came here to hear about my guest and our... I loved meeting Maggie. So Maggie Aderin-Pocock is a space scientist and space communicator, mother of one, a daughter who is 12. 13. She'll be turning 13 this year, I guess. 12 at the moment. And she was just completely lovely. Credit to my mum. It was actually my mum who suggested Maggie. I was aware of Maggie, but she's one of those people where the more I found out about her, the more I liked her. So as I was going to meet her, to chat to her, I was just kind of really feeling excited. There are some guests, you know, where you feel a bit more, you can feel a bit nervous. But she's so warm and lovely that I just knew all I needed to do was be, you know, with her to ask her some questions, and it was all gonna flow, because she's got that thing that all the best communicators and teachers have, where they are excited about the information that they have, but they want you to walk away with some new information, and there's no silly question. So I felt like I could have asked anything about science and space, and she would have taken it in the best way possible. So that was really lovely. And yeah, it's a really, really great chat. And it was lovely to spend time with her. We'd never met before, but I hope our paths cross again. Anyway, I will leave you with Maggie and I. It's now 10 to 4 in the afternoon. You never guess what I'm going to do. I'm going to go make a cup of tea, of course. Can't believe I haven't had any. Oh my gosh, actually, I haven't had a cup of tea since this morning. What is going wrong? I'm going to rectify that immediately. See you on the other side. It's so lovely to meet you, Maggie. I've been really looking forward to talking to you today. I've had your lovely voice in my ears a lot over the last week listening to Bits and Bobs. So why don't we start with the here and now? What are you up to at the moment?
Juggling plates, actually.
Not just spinning them, you're juggling them. Yeah. Throwing them up in the air.
I know. And it's seen how many actually crash lands. And so at the moment, I'm doing a book tour. So I was doing that sort of end of last year, and it's just sort of ramping up again this year. I do something called GCSE Science Live, which is really exciting because it's 2,000 15-year-olds in a theatre in London, for instance. And you know you've got to grab their attention, because if their attention starts to wane, the phones come out and the noise level, and before you know it, you're sort of swamped. So.
That's quite intimidating, actually.
Oh, you know, but teenagers. Then it's lovely. Because if you can grab their imagination and sort of talk to them about something that sort of, you know, that they're interested in, then it just feels like magic.
I bet. And I suppose, so what, have you got like a thing that normally is quite a good way to hook? Because I've heard you say that you quite like it when people say they're not interested in space and astronomy. What's your normal kind of hook for getting people into it?
So it varies depending on the group. One of the things is talking about sort of a life on other planets. I grew up watching Star Trek, however. Yeah, live long and prosper. It's just deep in me. And so, and all the things that Star Trek did, they sort of travelled, you know, out beyond our solar system, through the galaxy, to sort of other solar systems. And now with science, we're finding these other solar systems. We call them exoplanets. Mm-hmm. And the more we look, the more we find. So every star you see in the night sky is a sun like our sun. Some are bigger, some are smaller, but they're sort of stars. And in our galaxy, the Milky Way, there are 300 billion stars. And now we're finding that most of the planets we actually analyse have these exoplanets going around them. But we can do even more. We can actually sort of see, because planets don't give out light. Mm-hmm. Stars do, but planets don't. They just planets just reflect the light from their star. But if something, our nearest star is 40 trillion kilometres away. So I'm throwing a lot of big numbers.
No, I'm there. I'm right here for it. Press me at the end.
So our nearest star is 40 trillion kilometres away. And so the light reflected off a planet is just too dim to see. But we can use different techniques to find these planets. And now we're even looking at the atmospheres of these planets, seeing what chemicals are in there and looking for signs of life. So from sort of going from universities thinking, well, we're sort of I don't know if there are any other planets out there, to now we're finding sort of thousands of them and looking at their atmospheres and looking for life. We're progressing quickly.
God, it's so mind-blowing, isn't it? I mean, it's crazy. It is endlessly fascinating, though.
Yeah, I think so. But I think there are two sorts of people. Because, you know, I was bandying those numbers around. Some people, I sort of tell them those numbers, and you can see their face sort of looking more and more worried. How many billions of stars? How many billions of galaxies? And I think they feel sort of really sort of quite sort of overwhelmed.
Yeah.
But I think other people, you tell them that, and they think, oh my goodness, I'm part of something amazing. And I think that's my take on it. Yeah, I'm very small, very insignificant, on a sort of insignificant planet, out of billions out there. But boy, are we part of something amazing.
I know this is quite bizarre. It almost makes me feel a bit weepy as well. There's something about the magnitude of it.
Yes.
And that's all, it's not just an idea, it's real. That is all out there.
and was seeing it and analysing it and and trying to understand it.
Which is incredible. And I think I was thinking about my relationship with the sky above me and how I think so much of it is fused from when you're really little, because everybody, no matter where you are, we can all look up and gaze and think.
Yes.
And there's a sort of sense of wonder that you can sort of propel yourself up there, and then it's as broad as all that, you know, your thought, but also your association. I was thinking there's a similarity, actually, I think, in your instinct when you're small to be the wonder of space. That links up with the wonder of music as well. I think some of these things are quite instinctive.
Yes, yes.
I mean, there can't be a child on earth that doesn't really look up, you know?
No. Well, actually, but I think there are, because I think the problem is we live in cities with streetlights, and so people sort of, they get caught down below. Mm. And I think, yes, I think children still look up, but it's trying to sort of keep that wonder going. But what I love is that every culture across the world, and one of my challenges is when I was growing up, as sort of being black and female, I thought that all astronomy was done by white guys in togas.
Togas?
Yes, it was the Greeks and the Romans and people like that. Yes. But if you look across the world and the history of every culture, everybody's looked up, built monuments and celebrated. But I do know what you're talking about with that sort of that feeling of music. Mm. I remember borrowing a record, this is very much dating me, from the library when I was young, and it was the Brandenburg Concertos. And I put it on and it made me weep. And I was thinking, how can someone just sort of manipulate music to make me feel so emotional?
Yeah, that's incredible.
And it does, it transcends, it just makes the soul sing.
I think there's something as well about the timelessness of the emotions you're feeling. You know that sometimes if you're staring at the night sky, there's probably something that links you to ancestors far back and people yet to come.
Yes.
It's like that wonder is going to sustain, isn't it?
Yes, it's almost as if it's timeless and sort of we're looking up. And but that sort of plays with sort of time and the universe, because we see everything with sort of visible light. That's how we sort of perceive the universe ourselves. And light is finite. It takes a certain amount of time to travel. So it travels at a sort of 300 million metres per second, which is going some. Fastest thing in the universe. But it means that sometimes as we look at things, like our next door neighbour star, Proxima Centauri, it's taken 4.25 years for that light to reach us. In that time, Proxima Centauri could have blown up or disappeared or whatever. And we wouldn't know for 4.5 years or 4.25 years, because it takes that amount of time to... And we can see things from the early universe, because some of the things, it's taken billions of years for the light to get to us. So we're time travellers in that way.
That's an amazing thought in itself. I mean, just like actually letting that percolate a bit. And yes, because I suppose when you look up, a large proportion of what you're seeing is no longer...
Yes, we no longer exist, yes.
Which is incredible.
Because even... we never look at the sun, but light from the sun takes about 8 minutes to get to Earth. So again, it's sort of that time travel.
Yeah, that's astonishing. One of the things I was listening to in the last week was your Desert Island Discs, which you recorded when you were actually pregnant, I think, with your little girl.
Yes.
Can you remember how you were feeling back then about sort of impending motherhood?
Incredibly excited. It's something that I'd always wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And I had my daughter when I was 42, so I was sort of relatively old. And it's just sort of that it's happening. And I just felt so much excitement, but also terror. Because I think parenting is one of those things that's best done in theory. Because I think you can look from at someone else's, well, I think you should do this with your kids. But of course, when the kid's standing in front of you, I don't know, the kitchen knife and an ice cream, it's all, it's very different. It's sort of the reality. Yeah. And so I think I was aware of that. And it just seemed like the ultimate adventure. We were talking about sort of, music and space, but I think kids are the ultimate adventure, because it's a human sort of learning and sort of perceiving and sort of developing.
Yeah.
And I think that's magical.
It is magical. And also there's an unknown element in who you're mothering as well.
Yes, who they are.
Who they are. Yeah, exactly. What do they need from you? And I saw in the dedication to your book, you said something like, my daughter, she's now 12, is that right? Yes. She holds a mirror up to you. And I think there's something that does happen like that, where you learn about yourself.
Yes.
Through the things, where you find your challenges, your limits, the things you need to work on, also the fun things you really enjoy.
Yes.
About yourself, to
through seeing yourself reflected in this small person.
Yes, and because they sort of mimic what you say, they take on some of your mannerisms and things like that. Because I do lots of public speaking, and sometimes I've done a couple of talks where my daughter's been standing in front of me, copying what I'm doing, like a little mini me.
Oh, that's so sweet. Well, actually, you were doing talks when she's in a sling, and you were, this impressed me mightily. So I watched at the Royal Institute giving a talk, and your daughter at the time is at the stage where most people are struggling just to actually have a conversation, like meeting a friend for coffee and trying to keep an eye on a thread. But you're delivering this lecture about your career, and your daughter is literally pulling the sponge off the microphone, eating it.
She used to love that.
You seem really relaxed and natural. How instinctive was it to you just to take her with you wherever you went? I actually travelled with you for like the first 4 years of her life.
Yes, yes. We've got a little poster at home of a map of the world and all the places we travelled together. And because 2 days after she was born, I got invited to make a documentary, the BBC, called Do We Really Need the Moon? Which was a wonderful opportunity. I had literally just had Laurie. And so I said back, yeah, I'd love to do it, but, you know, I've just had my baby. And they said, oh, yes, we'll work around that. And so because of that, I got used to having her with me all the time. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because I look at the documentary now, and because I was breastfeeding her and sort of filming, and it was just sort of a roller coaster. And sometimes I see myself on the video and I'm sort of like, you're tired there. I can tell you sort of just slumped across the moon. Yeah, great. But I think because that got me into the mindset of being able to take her with me. And I used to do these lectures, and it just seemed naturally to have her with me. And so she'd come on the stage. And I remember once I was doing something called GCSE Science Live and sort of speaking to thousands of school kids. And a girl who was about 18 years old came up to the stage and said, I saw you with your daughter. And it made me cry because I've just had a baby and I really thought that my life was, you know, was over. But seeing you on the stage, just working, enjoying yourself and with your baby, it makes me think, okay, no, this isn't over. I can do stuff.
That's amazing. How powerful is that?
Actually, we were both like blubbing.
But that is interesting. That is amazing. And I think it is inspiring. And actually, I was thinking, you know, even where I'm at, I'm going to have that in my head, that there's so many options that we have, and sometimes you can feel that you don't have them when you just had a baby. But I mean, a lot of people, they think, okay, I've got to do this lecture, right? I'll try and leave enough milk, or I'll only be out for this many hours.
Yes.
And of course, that's fine if that's how you
do it. And I did some of that as well. I remember, forgetting the breast pump or something, and sort of getting very engorged with milk and thinking, So yes, but it is that juggling act.
Yeah.
But, and also, I think Laurie just got used to it at an early age, being on stage with mum, taking the foam off the microphones. I always wondered, yes, oh my God, the germs.
No, but you were so nice and relaxed while she's doing all that and never lost your thread. You'd always go straight back into the sentence wherever you were and keep going with all of it.
But sometimes, again, I look at those videos and I think, oh, well, I should have been at home playing with Laurie. But it was nice that we could do both.
Yeah, and then you continue to do both, and you've done TV together, haven't you? Which is lovely.
Yes.
CBBC.
Yes, that was very weird because it was in the middle of lockdown.
Mm.
And we were approached and said it would be nice to make this sort of a short documentary about space, sort of little facts and figures. But we need to do it sort of remotely. And I said, well, it happens I've got a really big green screen in my home, which we can set up. And so that's brilliant. And my annoy was there saying, I want to be involved. Well, yeah, can my daughter, sort of join in? And they said, yeah, that sounds brilliant. And so we did it in our kitchen. We sort of moved all the furniture and set up this green screen. But the director and the producer all had to sit outside because of COVID. They couldn't come indoors. And so they had a little canopy outside. And sometimes it was pouring with rain. And we weren't even allowed to offer them coffee because of, the bubbles.
Oh,
and so it just felt so bad for them. But it was amazing fun for me and Laurie.
Really fun. But your work did change a little bit when you had her, didn't it? Because you were, before that, you were working, I think you said you were doing your more sort of space science day job, like lab sort of work.
Yes.
And then the space communication. But that kind of took over priority after that?
Yes, because it was quite interesting because before Laurie came along, I was building, sort of working on things like James Webb Space Telescope, sort of building sort of equipment for that, sort of working on other sort of instrumentation, looking at climate change. So as a space scientist, it's quite an intense job, so long hours and things like that. Then on top of that, I was trying to do the science communication because I wanted the next generation of space scientists, or scientists anyway, or kids just reaching for the stars, no matter what their stars are. So I was going out and doing some of that, but it was quite a hard juggling act. And it was quite often because at the top of the company, the boss says, "Yeah, we really like what you're doing, Mag." But when you're sort of, when your manager's saying, "Where are you going?" "Oh, so I've got to go and give a talk to the school." "What, now? We've got, you know." So there was quite a bit of conflict there. And so when Laurie came along, it was, but it's funny, when she was, before she was born, I thought, okay, you know, I'll just continue being a space scientist, you know, I'll sort of look after Laurie and sort of, you know, and continue the science communication. And I realised that, sorry, in terms of spinning plates, that was just too many. Yeah. And I wanted to be with her, and that blew me away, because I thought, you know, sort of, I'll have a nanny, but no, I just wanted to be with her constantly whenever I got the opportunity. And so by doing the science communication, it enabled me to sort of take her with me and sort of do things with her.
Yeah.
So it just changed my mindset completely.
So did you have anyone that was in mind of you'd seen doing this thing of doing taking their babies to lectures?
No, I hadn't. It's funny.
Funnily enough.
Yes, I hadn't. But it's funny, I've met lots of people since who say, "Oh, yes, yes, I did that with my daughter." And one of the things I think is important is we get that out there.
Definitely.
Because I think people think that, yes, because we're few and far between, and it depends on so many factors, a sort of support at home, a child who is happy to sit on your arms while you're sort of yabber away. Mm-hmm. But many kids, I think, would do that if they're used to it. And so we should let people know that this is possible. And it means that there's just more flexibility than we realise.
Yeah, and it also, for me, when I was listening to you talk, it introduces a playfulness to hearing someone speak that breaks the sometimes, you know, the kind of tension that can happen when you're part of
it. Yes, sort of, I'm a lecturer, I'm speaking
to
you. Yes.
Because there's a little person there, you know, that's unpredictable.
And I think COVID did a lot of that because people recording from home or filming from home. Yeah, little people running in. And it's just, I love it. I think it really does break the ice and it just makes people human rather than, yes, I am a scientist up here on a pedestal. No, I'm a human and I've got a daughter and I love her, and yeah, let's all be happy together.
Yeah, and still be productive too.
Yes, yes.
We can bring new things to it. And so just so I get my head around it, but I mean, obviously there's the wonder of the space and the sort of poetry of that, but when it's the sort of nuts and bolts of being a space scientist,
yes,
what sort of thing does that normally involve?
Yes.
Because I'm thinking of applying. No,
join us, you know, it makes sense.
I'm going to be such a great asset. I already know it's 3.7 miles from the sun. I've memorised everything you told me.
But the thing is, funny, because people think you're sort of a working in the space industry. We need scientists, we need engineers. We don't, we need everybody. Because different people bring different facets. So it's like music. The music of the Swiss. It's sort of
something to a playlist.
Yeah. That was done for when one of the...
it's happened.
There's many more missions. We need more music. But you see, we bring different aspects. And that's one of the things I've found in my career, that I've had quite a varied career. But you bring different things. And companies that thrive have a diverse sort of a gene pool of people coming. And so I think the worst case scenario is that the space industry is just filled with space scientists because we all think in a similar way. And then you don't get the innovation.
Yeah, well, actually what you've said there reminds me of when they're talking about the fact that now there's much more awareness of hiring people who are neurodiverse. And you've spoken a lot about dyslexia. And I think that's maybe part of that you need people who think in different ways and process things differently.
Yes. And as a space scientist, what we do is we sort of come up with a concept. So you might get contacted by the European Space Agency who says, we want to see how plants are photosynthesizing, you know, how they're taking up oxygen and releasing, taking up carbon dioxide and releasing oxygen. Very important for climate change and what's happening on Earth. But you want to do it from space. Mm. So this is a sort of low Earth orbit, so probably about 300 kilometers up above the Earth's surface, above sea level. level. And so then we'll start, you know, brainstorming and thinking, how can we do that? What can we do? How are we actually going to measure this from so far away? And so then we come up with a concept, then come up with a design for an instrument, and then we have to miniaturise everything because getting things into space is expensive. And then you've got to work out, well, this is going to be powered by sun energy, by solar panels. Mm-hmm. So how much power can we use? And so we go through this whole process. But the joy of it is when we sort of build it and then it gets launched into space. And then, yes, it's operational and then getting data. But as a space scientist, we go through that whole process.
Yeah.
So from concept to sort of how do we tackle this problem to it's up there and it's working. Phew.
God, yeah, I didn't even think about the fact that you've got how you solve the initial problem, but then you've got to make it so that, as you say, it's actually miniature and lightweight and easy to set up and all those things. And if something goes wrong, how easy is it for the people that are there to be able to
No one there. That's the problem.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because these satellites sort of just orbit the Earth.
I was thinking of like International Space Station.
Oh, yes. Well, see, on the International Space Station, you have experiments.
This is just on
most
satellites.
Of them are just, just orbiting the Earth in a lonely...
Wow.
And so what we have to do, and we're quite right, we have to build in redundancy. And so we're trying to keep the weight as minimum as possible. Mm-hmm. But if a board goes down or electronics goes down, it's nice to have a backup.
Yeah.
Because some of these satellites cost you, I don't know, £500 million just to sort of design and get up there.
Yeah.
So you want to know that it's... James Webb's was a lot more.
Wow.
Yes. And James Webb sits 1.6 million kilometres away from Earth. So it's just out there. And so that's why...
When you say it costs more, how much is something like that?
James Webb, gosh. Well, definitely a few billion. A few hundred billion.
It's a lot of money in space.
It is.
Yeah.
But I think 10,000 scientists across the world, scientists, engineers, across the world working on it. So I love that as well.
Yeah.
So the community, we're all doing this together.
And I suppose, are there things that you would physically be touching that then end up all the way out there?
Yeah, and that's why I love that as well.
Isn't that an amazing idea?
Yeah.
Your fingerprints up there. That's incredible.
Fingerprints are never gone.
Sorry. No, you kept it very clean. Whatever you're supposed to have done.
Yeah, I've got them off afterwards.
Your metaphorical fingerprints.
But potentially my DNA.
Yes, exactly. Things like that. Just something you've interacted with.
This goes up. Yes.
That's incredible.
Because my lifelong desire has been to get out into space.
Yes.
And the only time reconsidered that was when my daughter was born, because I wanted to be here, and yet so we want to go into space together now. But so that was my crazy idea. But now by building this instrumentation that goes up into space and helps Earth, it's just the next best thing.
And how likely is the space mission for you and your daughter?
Well, it's getting, the odds are getting better.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you see things like sort of Virgin Galactic with Richard Branson and Elon Musk, and let's call it Battle of the Billionaires, guys who've made a lot of money and thinking, space, the next frontier.
Absolutely.
And I'm coming along, wait for me. Because in the past, space was mainly done by countries.
Mm.
And with that, they're limited resources, so limited in what you can do. But now it's sort of, with sort of these other companies coming up, more and more people want to get out there. Would you?
Yeah, I would actually. I've been to Houston and done the Parabola.
The Vomit Comet.
The Vomit Comet,
yes. I've never done that.
It's
and
really
I would
fun.
Love to. Yes.
You could definitely do that. Yeah.
Actually, there's been a few times where we've got close when I'm filming.
Mm.
And I was like, okay. And then it falls through at the last minute.
I actually did it for a job. It was a really crazy job.
Yes.
I was working with Walkers. They developed a lighter crisp. So I'm saying with a straight face, I promise. So obviously the correct way to illustrate that the crisp is lighter is to take me into zero gravity. So
with the crisp.
With the crisp. They're all floating around.
That sounds like the Simpsons one. He's just in space eating the crisps.
But the job came in quite last minute because I think they were struggling to find someone to say yes, but I love all that sort of stuff. I love roller coasters anyway.
Yes.
But also I thought this is a really unique thing. So for anyone listening who doesn't know what we're talking about, it's like you basically, the plane does what they call parabolas, where the plane is, it's essentially like if you're throwing a bucket of water around in a circle and the water stays inside the bucket when you spin it round because the water is falling with the bucket.
Yes.
So with the plane does these drops and then you're falling with the plane. So you experience zero gravity. So
weightlessness.
Yes. You touch the floor and you float off. And I think the thing that really unnerved me, and of course it makes complete sense, but I hadn't really thought about it, is the fact that there's no friction. So you just
keep going
till you bob against something else. You can't like swim back. So when you think of it being like underwater, there's elements of that in that you know you leave the floor, but you can't shift yourself one place to another?
No, it's quite...
You're passive in it.
Yeah, speaking to astronauts and on the International Space Station, you've got that, you know, constantly.
Yes.
And I was saying...
It must feel weird.
I'm quite messy. And I was saying, does it matter if you're messy in space?
Because I'm messy as well.
Yeah.
Oh, maybe that's why we haven't been asked for it.
But they were saying that sometimes that you sort of because everything is in that microgravity environment to effectively float, you leave something somewhere and then you sort of go on something and do something else. But then when the astronauts come back to Earth, they sort of leave something and falls to the ground. Oh, damn.
Yes.
so they're just used to it. Because they spend 6 months on the International Space Station.
That is so crazy. And they sleep like whichever way up they fancy.
Well, yeah, Velcro to the wall. Because, which way's up?
Yeah.
So, yeah, we need to go. We need to do this podcast from space.
Okay. I will put that on my diary. I would be well up for it. I think, of course, the risk element of the space mission is off-putting, but I think that the actual wonder of seeing our planet from far away, that must just be one of the most incredible sights.
That's one of the things I so desire to see. Mm. Sort of the curvature of the Earth from space, the atmosphere. And then just because you orbit every 90 minutes. Mm. So you go around the Earth and so you see day and night and different countries and, deserts and blazing sunlight and just see the whole planet.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
And it's funny, I think that's one of the things that really attracted me to space when I was a child, because I was growing up in the UK in sort of late 60s, early 70s, and I felt I didn't belong. My relatives would say, you don't even speak Nigerian, you're a lost Nigerian. And I'd go to school and people would say, why don't you go back home? I live around the corner. But yeah, you just... kids. And so space gives you that sort of we are united. There's no barriers. You don't see the countries from space. You just see planet Earth.
Yeah, I was thinking about that when you're talking about different countries having their space missions and how it would be great if everybody just teamed up, really. The whole space race thing is like teaming up makes the most sense to pool resources, surely.
And I suppose we have done that to a certain extent. So things like the European Space Agency, I think I can't remember sort of a different country, was Canada, many European countries all collaborating. But it's also interesting to see how things progress. Because I have a theory that there's been three eras of space. The first era of space was confrontation, because the space era came out of the Second World War, and it was mainly about lobbing intercontinental ballistic missiles from one part of the Earth to the other. Mm. And it just happened that they sort of clipped space while they were doing that. And then people realised that you could actually observe people from space, so space was actually quite useful.
Right.
And so it sort of came out of quite a dark time. Mm-hmm. And then people started sort of getting sort of, let's use space. And there was the space race with the Russians and the Americans. But then after that, people thought, space is pretty expensive. Let's start collaborating. Mm-hmm. So you get formation of the European Space Agency in 1975 and people coming together. But now I think we're going into the new era, and it's an era of commercialization, where you're getting people like Musk and Branson and many others thinking, how do we sort of utilize space? But in the era of collaboration, one of the things is space seems to be slower then, because it's all done by committee. Should we go to Mars? Should we go to the moon? I don't know. Let's think about it for a while. It's an awful lot of money. But then you're getting these pioneers saying, let's go to the moon, let's go to Mars and beyond.
You talked a little bit then about your childhood, and when I was driving here today, I was thinking, if there'd been, those books, Little People, Big Dreams, those books and I was thinking, I was double checking if there'd been one of you, because surely it's on the horizon if there hasn't been, because your story is extraordinary, because of when, your childhood being, as you said, the dyslexic girl, and this is before you knew you were dyslexic as well.
Yes.
And I think now the association we have with dyslexia is really positive. One of my kids is dyslexic, him it's quite a visible thing in terms of people talking about it and being aware.
Yes.
But certainly in the 70s, that was a different thing.
Yes.
And then also, am I right, 13 different schools in 14 years? That must be something of a record in itself. I'm not going to lie, because also you don't start till that's a quick turnaround.
Yeah, I think some schools it was, hi, bye.
Are you third of four girls, is that right?
Yes, yes.
And spent most of your time with your dad after a turbulent divorce from your parents, which I very much identify with. My parents split up when I was four as well. I heard you speaking about that thing of having to choose your loyalties and one parent, which is just a... it's a very tricky muscle to develop as a little person.
Yes, because it's a lot of responsibility and guilt. Yes. It's just
because you've always got an answer when you're that little, because normally life is quite binary about what you feel like about things.
Yes.
So I think it is really a tough conversation to be part of.
Yes.
But then also you've got the fact that you've got this, you know, you must clearly be incredibly bright.
Ooh.
So this oh, come on. You don't have to correct me on this. This is just factual.
But see, it's the way we measure brightness. See, because people think, oh, space science is, oh, that's tough. But it's like me and languages, to me, wow, that's tough. Or sort of people, sort of lawyers, reading all those documents. Because so people have strengths and weaknesses.
I agree with that. Because you've got this academic potential with space science. And then I was thinking you must have a massive amount of resilience and grit. Because surely if the odds are stacked against you, then you have to just keep on hitting the targets. And is that something that you've been very conscious of?
Yes. Well, it's funny, because one of the things about dyslexia is I think it teaches you resilience. And just as an example, it's you're sort of typing an email on the computer, and you type in a word, and the computer says, oh, rats. Okay, so you retype it. And it's like, okay, let's come up with a different word. So you're just used to sort of that sort of buffering.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I think one of the things that really worked for me is having that crazy dream of wanting to get into space. And because it means that though you sort of aim for targets, sort of quite often you miss and you fall in the mud and it's all gone horribly wrong. But when you've got the crazy dream, you sort of pick yourself up and think, oh, that was terrible. Ouch, that really hurt. But if I want to get to that dream, I've got to find a different way. So, okay, this isn't working. Let's go around this way or go over that way or just find another way around the obstacle. And I think that sometimes it's quite lucky if you have that desire when you're young, because you can just, it keeps you focused and sort of on track. And sort of, and I always think that I may never make it into space. I really hope I do. I may never make it into space, but by having that crazy dream, it's encouraged me to sort of push harder and overcome hurdles. And so not so much keeping hitting targets, but finding a way to hit targets when everything else just seems to be against you.
Yeah, and sometimes I think when you look back, because there's a sort of hardiness you have when you're younger that you maybe don't have in the same way when you're older, that when you're like teenage, or you know, if you've got that little fire in your tummy, sometimes you can look back and think, how did I have the energy to keep pushing and pushing?
Yes, the energy.
But I mean, how do you go about in trying to pass on this sort of resilience in your daughter? Because I would have thought that'd be quite a good quality to pass on.
Yes. Well, actually, because I think I'm quite lucky that I got it from my mother and my father. Because my father was well into education. I think that's another driver. I think it's often the case with immigrants, especially Nigerian immigrants, that your education is the way to sort of transcend. It's a social lubricant. If you want to sort of, if you want to improve your lot in life, it's got to be education, which was a bit of a dichotomy for me, because I was doing so badly at school when I started. But this idea that I have to get a good education. So it meant that there was that driving me as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite interesting, because I have conversations with my daughter, and because she is sort of quite heavily dyslexic, probably more so than me. And so it is sort of saying, so what is your dream? And she doesn't really know what she wants to do. She's got some ideas. But if you want to fulfill that dream, having an education really helps. And so in primary school, it was interesting, because I think she saw it, but, wasn't really into it. But now I think she's seeing that, yes. But also, it's quite interesting, because people, whenever they meet her, they say, are you going to be a scientist like your mother? And so I always feel bad for her, because perhaps she doesn't want to be a scientist like her mother. But she is actually enjoying science at school at the moment.
Mm.
She's now she's got to secondary school. And also, she's indoctrinated at home. I mean, she hasn't had a chance, really.
It's the conversations you have, isn't it?
Yeah, that's it, about everyday things that sort of is just immersed with science and engineering.
Yeah, and whenever people ask me if my kids are musical, I always say I just hope they have as lovely relationship with it as I do, because for me, music, never mind it being my day job, I just love the fact that music's always been there. For her, it doesn't really matter what her day job is, but if she just keeps that enthusiasm for wanting to know how things work the way they work, that's a lovely thing.
Yes, and it's funny, because when I go out to schools, people often say, well, do you want to speak to the gifted and talented kids who are going to become the future space scientists? And no, I want to speak to everyone, because as you say, it's just keeping that awareness of science.
Mm.
Science is plays such a vital role in our lives.
Yeah.
And in so many different ways, you know, inoculations. So for a while I was working in landmine detection.
Mm.
So many different decisions we have to make as a society,
yes,
that are influenced by science and engineering. And so if kids are turned off about it,
yeah,
how can they make societal decisions? So yeah, I want to speak to everybody about science and show the power of it, but show the power for good and the power for detrimental.
Yeah.
So yeah, so people are aware of, and when we make the right decisions, hopefully.
Well, like you mentioned landmines there, and I was thinking that's what you did, isn't it, after your degree, is that right? You went to do work for Ministry of Defence.
Yes.
So part of your job was working out how to detect where landmines are.
Yes.
So I was thinking about the fact that means you've almost had this silent dialogue, because you're developing science to help find out where the landmines are, but on the other side of that conversation is a team of scientists who try to make sure that landmines can't be detected.
Yes.
And that's a crazy, yes, silent dialogue to be in with people who, you know, who have maybe shared your passion for some of the same things,
yes,
to get them, you know, in engineering and science, and then, yes, they find out using it in that way.
Yes. Yes, and it must be a decision. When I got my sort of degree and my PhD,
mm-hmm,
left university, couldn't find a job, ended up working for the MOD, so the Ministry of Defence. And I was thinking, you know, it's the Ministry of Defence, but some of that defence, it can be aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
And so I made sure that I was only working in sort of missile warning systems, so warning pilots that a missile's coming, landmine detection. But yes, sort of there are people making different decisions and going sort of for sort of the more aggressive side. And it's quite interesting because war is a technology stimulator.
Mm.
When war comes along, people throw scientists at it to develop new technology, to develop new ways of sometimes killing people.
Yeah.
And so I think it's sort of, that's why we need to have that awareness,
yeah,
that science is just so, it's a double-edged sword.
Yeah, and the morality within what you're doing.
Yes.
And thinking about ethics and all these things, not just using your skill set to make the best of the best if the outcome is,
yes,
something you fundamentally don't agree with.
And I think that was wonderfully shown by the Manhattan Project. So when they were making the first nuclear bomb, scientists were sort of throwing themselves into sort of, you know, tackling this problem. And then after a while, they sort of stepped back, especially after Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They were looking back and said, what have we done?
Mm.
We were sort of caught up in the project, but this is devastating.
Yeah.
It's changed the world on a scale we cannot understand. And so yes, and so as scientists, but we need that little sort of, you know, the society saying, so what are you doing exactly, and where's that going, and should we be doing this? And that's a societal push. We need everybody to be in on that conversation.
And so did any of that shift or become even more part of your, you know, your motivation once you had your baby?
Yes. So trying to create a world that is safer, has sort of a climate that isn't that isn't toxic. It is. It's sort of a driving force. And I think we want to do it anyway. But when you think of sort of the next generation and the generation after that, and how far is this going? And so what can we do now? Because the decisions we make now have such long-fold sort of consequences.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, it does sort of really focus the tension on the future. Yeah, I'm passing through, but yes. And what about everybody else?
Yes, exactly. And I guess I think that also goes back to education.
Yes.
And I mean, I've got one child with dyslexia and two that have dyscalculia, which I'm sure you know about, the sort of maths version of dyslexia.
Yes. I have a bit of both, actually.
But. Well, yeah, it's quite often they're like, the
yeah, crossover. Interlinked.
Okay,
yes.
So with that, how did you not sort of fall out of wanting to go to school at all? How did you stay so committed to going into a place? Because most teaching is taught in such a way that's quite rigid, and I'm sure even yes. now with your daughter, even though it's generations on from when you were little,
yes.
it's still quite tricky.
It is.
Getting the support and
yes,
ways and, of
it, and I do see it as better now.
Mm.
And my daughter goes to a sort of local state school,
mm-hmm.
and yeah, and but also it's the way they've used dyslexia, because
mm-hmm.
it isn't just she can't read, she can't spell, put her in the sort of remedial class, which is what happened to me. But it's sort of yes, but look at her creativity, look mm. how logical she is, and so it's tapping into those sort of the benefits of dyslexia. But for me, actually, for quite a bit of schooling, I just hated it. I decided imagine, you know, school doesn't like me, I don't like school. I used to pretend to fall asleep in class.
Because I just pretend? Yes. I could do that for real.
Actually, in some French classes, it was real. And so it was good.
Why did you pretend for, just to zone yourself out?
Yeah, just, I didn't really want to be there.
That's got to be the ultimate insult to the teacher as well. Looking around the back like, oh, she's pretending to sleep in my lesson again.
Yes.
And then look at the time, they'd be like, she'll probably be at a new school by this afternoon. It's fine.
Just passing through anyway. Who's that person sleeping at the back? She wasn't here yesterday. So there was a sort of a time where school didn't agree with me. But then there were teachers who went above and beyond.
What happens if you have a teacher you love and then you have to move?
Oh,
I mean, because
yes.
That's moving school a lot. That is a big deal.
It is, but I think you get used to it. So it was funny, I didn't realise I'd gone to 13 different schools until I did a Desert Island Discs, which was lovely.
Yeah.
And so I was really honoured to be doing it, like doing this. But it was, they said, OK, let's do some research. And we started doing research. I said, oh, yeah, the schools. And the list just kept on going. It was, whoa, whoa, whoa.
You'd lost count.
Yes, yes. I wasn't really aware. And the thing is, I think I'm a sort of glass half full sort of person. And it does teach you skills. So in a new situation, other people might thinking, oh, you know, I don't know anyone. I'm more likely sort of, yeah, okay, let's just, you know, strike up a conversation, because mm-hmm. I'm used to being sort of, you know, thrown in the deep end.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some benefits of it, but you do lose out. And my husband, for instance, has friends he knew from primary school, and they're sort of, you know, they've known each other and grown up together. And but yeah, I don't really have that. And in some ways, I'm almost frightened of it. It's strange that I'm used to, I see myself as a chameleon. I'm putting another situation, and it's hard to go back and be the person I was there, because that was three schools ago and I don't know who that person is anymore. So there's, yeah, again, the yin and the yang.
Yeah. But then I guess you've given your daughter this thing that you didn't have, which is an incredibly consistent childhood, which is a very different thing, isn't it? If you've been moving around a lot and parents changing their situations and all that, it's quite a big difference to not have that when you're growing up, I think.
I think so, yes. And, it's quite interesting because in other ways, because she travels a lot with me.
Mm.
And so it's interesting because she moves around that way, but it seems more stable that way.
Mm.
And that's one of the reasons I love her coming with me when I go on trips and stuff like that. Because I suppose my husband and I are her constants.
Mm.
And to a certain extent, it doesn't matter where we are as long as we're together.
Yeah.
Just incredibly close to my daughter. Just
yeah, that's so lovely.
But I think it's also because she's an only child. I had her when I was 42, and I had quite a few complications afterwards. So there wasn't much chance of me having another child. And so, you see, yes, it's quite interesting because I'm sort of a mother stroke sister, which I love. But it can be complicated because, you know, it's sort of a sister, you can have fun together, but hey, why have you done your homework? It's sort of changing hats midway.
No, but I think that's the benefit. I mean, I'm close to my mum in that way too, and I think it's nice. Like, she never wanted to be my friend like that, but she's my mum and we're incredibly close. And I think that's the dynamic of close motherhood, actually. I think you can have that, can't you? And don't have to. She'll still look to you to be the person that gives her those boundaries. That's all part of it, isn't it?
I hope so. Yes.
Definitely.
I always think that when she's older, if we get on, she'll be, oh, my mother took me around the world and we sort of travelled together. It was lovely. But if we don't get on, it'll be, she dragged me around the world from place to place.
Well, if your dream is to go to space with your daughter, I think that's a very good litmus test for how well you get on. Because you're not going to agree to going to space with someone if your relationship's a bit.
Yeah, okay. But wait till we get there.
Exactly.
Either side of the International Space Station. I'm not talking to her. Just not.
Exactly.
She ate my chocolate biscuits and I'm not happy.
No, exactly. No, that's going to really put those things to the test. But it could be an amazing thing to do together.
Yes.
I do like travelling with my mum. I think I'd go to space with her.
Yes.
I think I would. Yeah, I'm going to say yes. You were about to talk about teachers. How did you find teachers that were significant if you're also moving around a lot? Can you remember teachers that had as a big steer on you?
Yes. I remember moments and teachers. So I remember a moment when I was in a science class, and this was when I was pretty disengaged in school. And I think one of the reasons I was disengaged is because I thought, I'm dumb. I'm at the back of the class, you know, safety scissors and glue. I'm just disconnected. And education isn't my thing. But I remember sitting in a class and a teacher asked a question. And the question was, if a litre of water weighs 1 kilogram, what does 1 cubic centimetre of water weigh? And being dyslexic means I'm quite logical. So I worked out that 1 cubic centimetre of water is 1/1000th of a litre. 1/1000th of a kilogram is 1 gram. So 1 cubic centimetre of water is 1 gram. Well, yeah, I got this. Put my hand up. And then looked around the classroom. No one else had their hand up. Being the dumb one at the back, I thought, you know, how can I get this? And no one else does. So just, you know, put my hand down. So the teacher sort of noticed that, and encouraged me to answer. And I got it right. And it was, you know, oh, that magical moment of, oh my goodness, yeah, I knew this and other people in the class didn't. So I'm not as dumb as they think and I'm not as dumb as I think. And that gave sort of the momentum that, okay, if I can do this. And to me, it's all about that confidence.
Yeah.
Confidence is what I think makes and breaks people in, definitely in school, but in most walks of life. When you've got the confidence, you think, okay, well, if that works, what else can I do? And then you push a little harder and you sort of, you know, gain some more knowledge. But if you feel, oh no, I can't, you know, yeah. then that's what stops you.
Yeah, and fear of saying the wrong answer.
Yes, and everybody else sort of looking.
That's quite crippling, isn't it, for a lot of kids, I think.
And I think with the dyslexia, just like reading out loud, you know, the fear of the wrong word.
that's a very real fear. I mean, how many of us even now as adults have anxiety dreams about school, you know? There's a reason why. And it's also that you're never again in the melting pot of so many different characters and having to just rub alongside people in that way.
True.
Because then after that you can choose, you know, who you socialise with, and in your work you're likely to be with people. We've got, you know, you're all bringing things to the pot, but school is...
It's pretty cutthroat.
Pretty hardcore. Yes. Oh, yes, definitely. And I think it's amazing to have a moment like that, a school moment that actually was so defining.
Yes.
Not many people have that real, like, that literally was like a light bulb going on.
Yes, like, and right, so, and that was a change, and of course, lots of other things. And as I say, fantastic teachers who went sort of above and beyond and sort of gave me extra lessons. And lots of teachers would make me keep a diary. I hate keeping a diary. But you sort of would write and sort of like correct my spellings and things like that. Mm-hmm. So I could sort of develop a bit better.
And so how is it when you get to sort of here and now and you're helping sort of GCSE and also younger kids get engaged? Is that teaching something that really means a lot to you?
Yes, because I know what it's like to be disengaged with school. And that's why I like to speak to all pupils when I go to a school. And so I know what it's like sitting at the back of class thinking, this isn't for me. And especially with science, you get some kids coming in when I'm going to give a lecture and you think, oh, I don't want to be here. This is a science talk. What would I want a science talk? And so then I want to entertain them and regale them and sort of and wow them with just 101 different things. So they come out and think, wow, that was science. Yeah, that's here. And just think again. Mm. So, and there's a joy in that. I think over the past... about 18 years, I've seen 450,000 people. And there's a spark as well when you interact with someone. Or I gave a talk once at a school and someone was doing sign language, which you might notice I talk quite fast. Simultaneous translation, sign language. I always feel sorry for them because their fingers are like friction. May catch fire. I gave this talk at a school, and later on I got an email saying that there was a little boy in the group who was a voluntary mute and had never sort of spoken to their teachers. But after my talk, he wanted to know what happens if galaxies collide, and so he started speaking about that. And so it was just sort of this magical moment because it was something that caught his attention so much and that he was so interested in that he started speaking. And so you think, whoa, it's powerful stuff. I'm lucky I'm doing space because space really gives it that power. But if you can go out there and share that with someone and share that passion, it's just an absolute joy.
That is incredible. That's amazing. It's funny you mentioned about talking fast because just before Christmas, I went to a friend's Christmas drinks and there was Lauren Laverne.
Oh, yes.
And Lauren Laverne, of course, now does Desert Island Discs. And she was saying when she's doing her research on people, she listens to the audio of people, like their books or podcasts, whatever, at double speed. Oh. So I thought I'd give it a go and I tried one of your podcasts and I couldn't... You're the wrong person to put double speed.
I'm trying to pack so much in there anyway.
It's like, whoa, I can't. And then I thought, no, it's right. She just speaks quite. I'm a fast talker as well, by the way. So I totally get that. But I was just like, whoa. If you ever want, hear yourself a double.
I'm going to try that.
Yeah, have a listen to it. It's amazing. But I couldn't keep up.
Actually, 1.5 might be okay.
But I'm listening to you. You've got so much enthusiasm and exuberance. And I'm trying to picture.
if little Maggie had that? Is that something that's grown and blossomed with your confidence and with the more you've sort of grown into find your own space in, excuse the pun, of what it is you're doing, you know, your workplace? Or yes. Was that, if I'd bumped into you at school, would you have had that same thing then?
It's very hard for me to tell. Mm. Because as a child, I was convinced that I was an introvert. I was sort of, you see, because I have three other sisters, so two older, one younger. And my two older sisters are larger than life characters. I mean, they're just amazing. And so compared with them, I was sort of the quiet one. And so I always used to say, I'm the quiet one. I'm the introvert. But I think I'm quite extrovert. That's an omnivert. Because I like the quiet times where I can sort of have to myself and sort of, contemplate life, the universe and everything. But at the same time, there's the sort of performer in me that likes to sort of get out there and sort of, just sort of challenge people with ideas. Mm-hmm. So I think as a child, I wasn't very confident at all. And I think I was almost crippled with decision making. Every decision I'd sort of agonize over sort of for a long time, like, is this the right one? And then after I've made the decision, I still think, I heard you talking about regret. And it's sort of a challenging things to have. And sometimes I'd sort of, but things, sometimes it was silly things like sort of bread or toast. I had toast. What was I thinking? So the big questions then.
I can relate. The correct answer is toast, probably.
Actually, nowadays, I think I'll just go for toast. Bread, but crunchy.
Yeah.
So I don't think I was that confident. And also, because of the dyslexia and all the other things, I think I was, in the sort of family pecking order, I was sort of a nice but dim.
Oh, no. I find that hard to believe. But I think if you've got big extrovert siblings, that's quite another thing. That's part of the family dynamic. And yes. In a big family, everybody kind of finds their pitch a little bit.
That's it, yes.
It's a way of survival, I think, sometimes.
Yeah, and we know sort of, and it's as we grow and develop, then sort of sometimes you sort of, and that's one of the things about changing school a mm-hmm. lot. It mm-hmm. means you can sort of, I didn't like the role I was playing in that one. I'm going to try this one.
And do you think being a mum and motherhood made your relationship, your love affair with what you do expand a little bit as well?
I think so. It's quite interesting because I loved it before, but actually, and especially when Laurie was in my arms and I was giving a talk, it just made me, I don't know, it made me feel very complete. The things I love, I sort of loved communicating, mm-hmm. And I have my daughter with me. As a space scientist, I knew she'd always be at home. I couldn't take her to the office, mm-hmm. but this enabled me to do both. And there's an image my husband gave to me probably a couple of years ago, and I'm going to pronounce it incorrectly, but I think it's called Ikigai. And it's a diagram with four circles, all interconnected. And one is what you can get paid for, what you love doing, what the world needs, and the other one, which I can't remember. Anyway, I'll come back to that. But in the bit in the centre is where you get life fulfilment. So Ikigai is sort of a Japanese life fulfilment. And if you can get all these circles together, get them all working, then you can sort of happily sit in the centre. And my husband sort of gave me this picture and said, I think you might be in the centre. So
that's lovely.
Yes.
I like that very much. So what's your... But the big things about space that are kind of unanswered that you'd like to know the answer to?
Yes. And one of the things I love to tell kids is that there are some big questions out there. One of the things is that when we look at the universe, we know what about 6% of the universe is made out of.
6%?
No, it's embarrassing.
What have you been doing with your time?
So me, you, the table, we don't know about that stuff that reflects light. But there's also stuff we call dark matter and dark energy, and we call it that because we don't know what it is. We know it's out there because we can see its gravitational effect, but we can't actually sort of tangibly interact with it. And so that's what I like to tell the kids, 94% of the universe we don't actually know what it's made of, so come and help us because we really need it.
That's so amazing, isn't it?
Yes. The Holy Grail is their life out there.
Yeah.
And but I'm excited that we are getting closer to answering that, because with things like James Webb, with telescopes looking at these exoplanets. But one of the nice things is we used to talk about planets in the Goldilocks zone, room, where they're the right distance from their local star, so they're not too hot, not too cold, just right to have liquid water. And so we thought we had to look
at Goldilocks. That's good.
But now we realise that because we found life in thermal trenches deep in the oceans where we didn't think life could exist, it opens up the possibility of where we might find life even in our own solar system, like some of the moons of Jupiter and Saturn, where because they're going around such a massive planet, the gravitational forces sort of heat up waters under an icy shell. So there could be life, a moon like Enceladus, you know, but we don't see it because it's underneath this icy shell, but it's just exciting what could be out there.
I guess it means as well what you're thinking of as when you say life on other planets, you're thinking about, you know, the equivalent of humans, or are you thinking about something totally different?
So
you know?
It could be just sort of some sludge.
Yeah. Which, don't get me wrong,
it's life.
I'm kind of looking for the alien type, you know, the classic.
Yes, yes, with the extra eye and slightly
something
green.
Like that. Yeah, something fun like that. Yeah,
as depicted
on
Star Trek.
An unexpected limb, an unexpected head,
yes.
Eyes.
But you see, the thing is, those aliens generally look like us, but yeah, with a bit of extra appendage.
But it's easier for the costume department.
But I like coming up with, a few years ago, I was invited to make a portrait of an alien. And I came up with this sort of a... We have planets like Jupiter, where we don't even know if it's got a rocky core, so it's just atmosphere. And so I came up with this lovely, sort of about the size of a football pitch, and it was like a sort of a blob. And it wasn't... all our DNA and our bodies are carbon-based, but this was silicon-based. Mm. And it sort of sucked in nutrients from the atmosphere, and but it communicated through lights, scintillation, so it sent in communication through lights, and just totally way away from anything that we know. And there's a whole area of science called astrobiology. And as we detect these exoplanets and look at their atmospheres, it's working out what sort of life could live on a planet like that. And to me, that's mind-boggling.
Yes.
It's like science fiction and science. So you take the science we know and take it in and extrapolate it out. And it's just wonderful.
I'm sure that's the most addictive thing about working in an area such as space, is that if you've got a kernel of something, you can just push. Yes. If you can think it, it might be.
Yes. And also, because what I love about science fiction is it sort of inspires scientists. So like the communicators on Star Trek became mobile phones. You can see an idea and think, well, hold it, why can't we do that? Okay, that is science fiction, but it's usually based on some reality. So yeah, let's investigate, let's do it.
Yeah, and a lot of people that worked on science fiction projects are probably people that had a real passion for space and knowledge and try and, you know, get as much as they can.
Yes,
and go, then, right, imagination, yes, go wild.
Yes. And I love that.
Yes,
and
yeah,
and it just leads to different opportunities, and also sometimes drives the science as well.
So do you sometimes watch things with your daughter, like science fiction films and things, and then she'll say, how realistic is this one?
Yes. If it's good science fiction, then I can suspend disbelief, because I must say I love science fiction. Science fiction saved me, because as a dyslexic, I hated reading. But my sister would tell me about some of the science fiction books she read, my sister Hal, and I'd say, oh my, that sounds amazing. And I'd actually read the book. I'd get half the words wrong, but I'd read the book because it was such a compelling story. So I love that. And yes, my daughter and I do sort of watch science fiction together, and I try and suspend the disbelief as much as possible, because I want to enjoy it, but sometimes it's okay, you've pushed it too far, this ain't happening.
It's probably quite often, isn't it, if you're honest. Well, I think it's all incredibly exciting, and I feel like, yeah, we should put a date in our diary for like 20 years and do our next instalment in space.
Well, it could be space or Mars. I mean, we've got options.
I'm open. My diary is clear. And until then, I want you to live long and prosper, please.
And same to you. Thanks so much. Lovely to speak to you.
Really nice to talk to you too. I'm all excited. I am. I feel like, space is cool.
It's all out there.
See, isn't Maggie just so warm and infectious? And I hope that she and her daughter get to have that exploration of space together. It's pretty magical. I'd quite like to go to space. My 10-year-old Ray's in the room. Ray, would you go to space with me? If we could, if it was like a rocket that would take us to space, would you want to go with me? He's walking away from me. Fine. Did you say fine?
Maybe.
Maybe. All right. Mickey, I'll be there in a second.
I might get a speed stick. I won't be there for ages.
Well, yeah, it's unlikely to be a quick trip, let's face it. But, you know, imagine seeing the Earth from space. That would be pretty amazing. Anyway, I'll work on that. I'm not sure I've found my space companion just yet. Maybe. It's probably the most sensible answer, to be fair, by the time we get to it. Anyway, yes, thank you so much to Maggie. Thank you so much to you, of course, and to producer Claire, editor Richard, and lovely Ella May, who does the artwork. I've got so many more amazing women coming up for you in the next few weeks. And I realised yesterday, actually, when I did my recording yesterday, it was my 90th recording. I've done 90... I've spoken to 90 amazing women. How cool is that? Anyway, I'm being heckled from the other room by my four-year-old. His patience doesn't last too long. I'm coming, Mickey! And I've got things to tidy. And, I decorated the boys' room. I've got three of my kids in one room and I've redecorated it this week. And, you know, there's that fun bit where you decorate and everything looks really lovely. You start putting things back in and you're like, oh, it looks great. And then you realise it's because you've only put a third of the things back that should go in there. So upstairs there's a bath that's filled with boxes of all the other stuff. And quite frankly, I could probably just put that whole lot in the bin now and just have what we got. You all right, Ray? But anyway, it does look lovely, though. I put a bit of wallpaper up in one corner of the room. It looks bloody lovely. Get excessively overexcited about it. But then my seven-year-old Jesse is the same as me. He's decided when he's older he wants to be someone who helps people organise their homes. So he's put up some little acrylic shelves for all his little display items. And he just said to me, he's on the top bunk, he said, Mummy, the ladder up to my bed is the stairs to heaven. Now I'm in heaven in my bedroom. He's so happy. He and I get very excited about interiors. It's a nice way to be. And I think Ray's happy with it too. Kit's not so sure. Anyway, I better go. Mickey's calling me. See you next week. Take care of yourselves. Have a lovely time. Lots of love. Bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
it. Coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.